stop.
Mr. Harry Belafonte is an internationally known actor and musician, also an activist. His voice and face instantly familiar from a half a century of recordings and performances on radio, television, film, and stage. He has used his voice to tell the stories and express the aspirations of life and struggle outside the charmed circle of affluence. Born in Harlem in 1927, his mother sent him to live in her native Jamaica when the Great Depression tightened its grip on the United States. The island's culture later became a rich source of his artistic expression. In the early 1950s, Mr. Belafonte met the young Martin Luther King Jr., forming a friendship that lasted until Dr. King's death in 1968. Dr. King said of his friend, "Belafonte's global popularity and his commitment to our cause is a key ingredient in the global struggle for freedom and a powerful tactical weapon in the civil rights movement here in America. We are blessed by his courage and moral integrity." In the 1980s, Mr. Belafonte spearheaded the project known as USA for Africa to help combat war, famine, and drought. In 1987, he was appointed UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. Mr. Belafonte has been honored by groups as diverse as the Urban League, the American Jewish Congress, the State Department, the NAACP, the National Council of Black Mayors, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, Hadashah International, and the Peace Corps. He was the first recipient of the Nelson Mandela Courage Award, and in 1994, he received the National Medal of Freedom. His dedication to the causes of the oppressed continues worldwide. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome the founder of the Gathering for Justice, Mr. Harry Belafonte.
Well, here he is. Last night I was with the wild one, Malia Lazu, and she was talking to me about how overwhelmed, you know, overcome she was with the kind of response and turnout that she saw coming here into Oakland and at the Marriott. But she was also struck with a sense of humor that so many young people, in talking to her, expressed to her that, my daddy or my mama used to talk about that man. And does he still sing? I'm even surprised to hear he's still around. And that's very prophetic in a way for me, because when I turned 75 some years ago, I decided that I had done my time. And I wanted to take off and get some space and see this world that I had experience so frequently, but never had a chance to delve into deeply. And so I decided I'd just take off and go into the wilds of Costa Rica, into the rainforest. And I'd go off to Madagascar and see the lima and all the strange and wonderful creatures God has put on our earth. And I got to a little island in the Caribbean and tried to walk in there with anonymity, my hat down, and trying to look a little locally funky. And I heard this loudspeaker blaring out this music with all the local melodies and rhythms. And I decided that I'd go into this little record shop and see if I could hear what was the local choice, and find me a song or two, and maybe enrich my own repertoire. And when I walked in, there was an elderly black woman sitting there, the manager of the store and the salesperson. And I walked over to the record bin and I started to look through the records. And I looked through the records and I saw Stevie Wonder, and I saw Chuck D, and I saw a whole bunch of folks, mostly Americans. And then I began to come into some of the native, the indigenous artists and music. And my curiosity peaked, and I looked further and further to see who else was there. And I looked even closer to see who else was there. And then I began to really look to see who else was there. So after a little frustrating moment, I walked up to the lady and I said, excuse me, miss, but do you have any records by Harry Belafonte? And she paused when she looked at me. She said, who? And I said, Harry Belafonte. And she said, no, I don't think so. You know, but I tell you something, a lot of people come off the boat and they come in here and now and then they ask for that man. And you know something? I think he long time dead. Well, by my presence here today, I have dismissed that rumor. But it is not a rumor that stands without reason. The work that I do doesn't quite get to the headlines every day. It's too troublesome. It's too mischievous. It shakes too many bones. But I tell you, the reward that I feel by your presence here today can only be fully measured by the humility that embraces me because of it. Here in America, if the crisis that is upon us in this 21st century is to be reversed, it is you. You who will be the ones to do so. In our last face-to-face meeting before Martin Luther King Jr. went to Memphis, Tennessee to lead the sanitation workers' strike, he in a solemn moment said, you know, Harry, we've worked long and hard for the rights we are gaining. But in our struggle for integration, I've come to the belief that we are integrating into a burning house. And I said to him, Martin, if that is your belief, then what is our course to be? And he thought for a moment, and then he said, we'll just have to become firemen. The full measure of that prophetic remark would not clearly reveal itself until the emergence of George W. Bush and the great villainy that he has visited upon this nation and the peoples of the world. The violence that engulfs us is not new to our America. This nation was conceived in violence. When Europeans came here and tasted the wonders of what this continent had to offer, their first engagement was to destroy a civilization that existed for centuries before their arrival. They embarked upon the greatest act of genocide then known to humankind. And after the indigenous people were wiped out, the new conquerors, seeking to satisfy their greed and lust for greater power, turned to the full measure of their villainy toward the enslavement of millions of Africans, an act for which we here gathered today are still being victimized and are hoping to find solution. All of you young men and women sitting here, and the thousands more you will reach out to, of the firemen Dr. King envisioned we would have to be if America is to be saved. We are in a war against an enemy that possesses no moral truth. Everything touched by them becomes contaminated, and our people are paralyzed in the wake of the fear that has been visited upon us. Those who have been anointed by us to be the caretakers of the precious articles of our Constitution have betrayed us. The nation is caught up in the desperate hope that the coming elections will change the present regime. That may be, in fact, the case. But we must be aware and beware of who we reward with the precious gift of our vote. In 1965, because of the Voting Rights Act, Black America felt for the first time in our history with this nation the sense of a future that held promise that all things were possible. With the alliance made by our Latino brothers and sisters, like Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, the valiant men and women of the American Indian Movement, with warriors like Chief Orrin Lyons, Dennis Banks, and Leonard Pelletier, who still languishes in prison after almost half a century. Our Asian comrades like Yuri Kochiyama and Richard Aoki, the courageous white workers and leaders like Harry Bridges and Justice William O. Douglas and Bill Kunstler and Eleanor Roosevelt and Bob Zellner of SNCC. We felt an invincibility that did not linger long. Yes, it was a time of great promise, but then the nation's hedonist spirit was vulgarly awakened, and with a vengeance, our greed, our selfishness began to devour our souls. In that moment of our spiritual and social contamination, the devil saw opportunity and sent in his disciples to reconquer his threatened kingdom. From a nation of we the people, we became a nation of I the person. We became indifferent to our neighbor's existence. African Americans moved on to positions of new power. We became the governors of states, the mayors of cities, the legislators of state government, congressmen and women, and senators in federal government. We were to be seen everywhere as policemen and women, district attorneys, FBI agents, CIA operatives, high officials in the Defense Department, head of the National Security Council, chief of staff of the armed forces, secretary of state, diplomats to foreign governments, and hundreds of other positions of significant influence. And with all this anointing, we mindlessly and selfishly abandoned our communities and abandoned values. We all stood by as Justice Thurgood Marshall, the great liberator, the architect of Brown versus the Board of Education, the jurist of hope, and all that he stood for as it was traded in for the jurist of injustice, Clarence Thomas, who with a heart filled with vengeance imposed and imposes the disease of self-hate on our people. In our Congress, the Black Caucus, as it grew in size and power, became the Black Conspiracy. On their watch, black people lost what little health care systems we had. Now pollution. Incurable lung diseases, HIV/AIDS, from which more of us die than any other race in the nation, have become our curse. On their watch, we now have the largest prison population in the world, over 2.25 million incarcerated. As a matter of public policy, we build more prison cells than schoolrooms. And in the face of this expansion, the system has given prison labor to the private sector. In America's free enterprise system, nobody in the real estate business builds rooms anywhere who don't expect full occupancy. In the face of this reality, what is the enemy saying to us about their vision of the future? Our children have become the killing fields for corrupt, racist police authorities. And what more are they telling us when they reach into our classrooms with their harvesting machines of contempt to put in chains and emotionally brutalize five-year-old children like Jashia Scott in St. Petersburg, Florida? Somebody is telling us something, and we don't seem to be listening. Everywhere, our school buildings and systems are decaying. Education has become a passing curiosity for thousands of our children who more and more are becoming drug lords and destroyers of life. As the great American educator and philosopher, Dr. Cornel West, who profoundly understands who is on the cutting edge of our struggle, has duly noted, too many people in whom we have placed our trust have betrayed us. They are living too comfortably in the midst of the humiliation and indignities that millions caught in the cruel abyss of poverty are required to endure. Many of our elected officials have arrogantly concluded that their lust for power camouflaged in the myth of the great American dream will ensure that they will not be held accountable. Well, we will show them differently. Our task is to make them uncomfortable. Our task is to make them very uncomfortable. It is conceded that there are exceptions to the rule. Many say, that's politics. The rule, the exception to the rule itself is so pervasive that it blurs the exception. Many say, that's politics, and I say, no, it's not just politics. It's twisted ambition and indifference. If one white senator can filibuster and bring government to a halt, who can ask us to believe that the black caucus, with over 40 members in Congress, can't even catch a rabbit? It is unacceptable, totally unacceptable. They should be using our political capital to stop the machine. This nation must be led to understand that if its first order of business in this 21st century is to end oppression. Oppression in all of its forms. It is our responsibility to let it be understood that if the business of the poor is not the first order of business, then nobody can do business. Polish immigrant worker in the 1920s at the dawning of the labor movement wrote a short poem to the banks of America. And I quote, he said, "Calculate carefully and ponder it well, and remember this when you do, that my two hands are mine to sell. They made your machines, and they can stop them too. That is the power of my hands." To us here today, I say we have the power, and it is in our hands. We can stop the machines, and we are required to do so. To us here today, I say you have the power. It is your hands, and you must use it. And you are far more powerful than the machine of oppression. The church, the relentless kidnapper of truth, charges us a ransom that is unpayable. Ministers, wrapped in their glittering robes of deceit, barter with the souls of poor folks. They gleefully betray their higher calling as they pimp on the flock for the 30 pieces of silver cast before them by the new emperor of right-wing Christian evangelical zeal, George W. Bush. With his assassins, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Alberto Gonzalez, and others who lead the new crusade against the colored people of the Arab world. I have always believed that culture is the most powerful force in human existence. In culture resides artists. And as creators of art, artists have been throughout history the supreme protectors of truth. It is through art that we know our past, our history, and who we are, and what brings things to us, and what we do with things around us. As the guardians of truth, artists have been central to the struggle against oppression. And no one understands that more fully than the artists who have documented the liberation movements of history. Dr. King always understood the power of culture and the importance of artists. He never failed to call upon us, and we never failed to embrace his wishes and to sustain his cause. From the time of slavery, the world could only know the truth of the experience of Africans through the songs we sang, the words we spoke, in our plea to the heavens for liberation, and the secrets that passed among us orally in our resistance to tyranny. The oral tradition was one of our greatest tools of liberation, and that fact never changed, that is, until now. The lords of commerce have strangled culture and holds it in bondage, and many artists have submitted to that villainy. Instead of triumphant songs and stories that would inspire us to overcome the anguish of the day, we have capitulated to the will of the banks. The heart of black culture, where so much of our history resides, instead of being a mighty force in the forefront of today's struggle, is muted by the 21st minstrels, the 21st century minstrels, who for the price of celebrity bow before their masters. Through their masks of buffoonery and keeping their masters happy, they have failed to see that the gold that hangs around their necks and the diamonds that glitter on their fingers are nothing more than the chains of slavery, hardly any different than the chains that held our African ancestors in slavery. We're gathered here today to seek change, to change all those wrongs and much more. It is for us to but recall our history, and in so doing, once again realize that all things are possible. The slaver knows that if they control what people know, they can control what people do. They have repeatedly drummed into us through the instruments of communication the idea that the civil rights movement is a relic of the past, that it sits somewhere in the dustbins of history. What it was is no longer applicable, they say, to the solutions needed in confronting the great problems of today. Most of the nation bought that scam. Many have yielded to the tragic belief that the machine is invincible. If you stay the course we're embarking on, you will not be spared the wrath of the powerful. They will seek to destroy you. Their history is well documented. You cannot resist their interests and return, expect their response to be benevolent. Their hands are washed in blood, the blood of past history, and it's washed in blood today. You and I will not be exempt from their tyranny and their villainy. We will not be exempt from it. But you must understand the most precious and the most powerful weapon in the arsenal of choice stands in us. It's in our hands. It's in our hands, and it is called the weapon of nonviolence. It is the most powerful tool known to humankind. And those who have dared to practice that philosophy have paid a price. Gandhi was assassinated. Dr. King was assassinated. Malcolm X was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. Allende was assassinated. Lumumba was assassinated. I can go on and on because the list is endless. And I dare tell you now that some of you in this room, some of us in this room, are targeted. We too could become victims of assassination by those who would deter us towards a more glorious path in human development. You are the only hope. And Dr. King talked about the firemen. He said, I'm not a racist, but black America and the peoples of color of the earth must understand that they are the redeemers of anything that could be considered human glory. When I saw that young child in St. Petersburg being handcuffed, I understood that America had reached a new depth of villainy. I could not understand how that child could have been so tortured and humiliated, and that the streets of America were not filled with black men and black women, black workers, people who said this villainy will go no further. And she was not an exception to the rule. There are hundreds of such children around the nation. How can we permit this to linger unabated? Who are we? What are we expecting of life? What are we thinking about that makes us so mindless and so incapacitated? Well, I say we are not mindless, and we're not incapacitated. And your presence here is testimony to that fact. The future The future of the world lies in the hands of youth. And that's not just hyperbole. That's a fact. Let me tell you that when I met Dr. King, he was 24 years old. I was 26. When I looked around, when I found a mindless black leadership and a white world that was caught up in fanciful things that had nothing to do with oppression and the relief of it, we had to turn to new voices and new choices. And those who stepped into the breach, those who filled the gap and filled it gloriously, were young men and women who were 17 years old and 18 years old and 16 years old. John Lewis, glorious congressman, was 17 years old, preaching to chickens. Julian Bond was 18 years old. Diane Nash was 17 years old and with child. I can go on and on. Thousands of young people all over this country in the SDS and in other branches of social organization rose up and seized the navigation of this country. And they served us well. They stopped the war in Vietnam. They brought the government to its knees. They changed the horizon of the future. And there's nothing that says you can't do the same. Do not be afraid. There's nothing to fear, like Roosevelt said, but fear itself. Step out. Look him in the eye and tell him your day is done, brother. Your time is over. We will take this no longer. And it is not just us who sit here that say this. I've taken Nani Alejandras, and he took me. And Bo Taylor, and Bloods, and Crips, and young people. We've gone to Latin America and looked at our Latin American brothers and sisters in Colombia, in Bolivia, in Venezuela, in Brazil, in Guatemala, in Mexico, and they have risen up by the millions to say an end to exploitation, an end to oppression. We've gone through Africa, all over the continent together, and reached out to young Africans who say the same thing, and their arms are open wide. People keep calling us minorities. We're not a minority. Ain't nothing minor about us. We're not a minority. We're the majority, and we got to start acting like that. Yes, I can be charged with all sorts of things and expect to be. You're going to be charged with what? Sedition? They're going to call me what? Anti-patriotic? They're going to say that I am violently seeking to overthrow the government? Well, not all of that is true. But I am completely and fully devoted to change. I want to thank Barbara Lee. She's more than just a congressional leader and a wonderful woman. She's a mighty, mighty warrior. Long before she romanced with the idea of sitting in the Congress of this country, she was in the streets of America, changing and challenging this system. She inspired us. And what a wonderful thing that she should have been the ruler of this district. And how fortunate for us that I could pick up the phone and call her and say, come home, Harry. Come on to Oakland. Let's start it here. I thank you, Barbara. It was a great gift. It's a great place to start. And Ron Dellums, who is the mayor, I knew him as a youngster when he was in the Congress. And the valiant things that he did, He gave us his city and the opportunity to be in this place, to be able to talk and to converse and to exchange thoughts in dignity. We're all here. We're here because in the first moment that I understood we had to do this, I knew that it was not just a black thing. It had to be an Asian thing. It had to be a Pacific Rim thing. It had to be a white thing. It had to be a Latino thing. It had to be a people thing. It had to be a genderless thing. I only got another minute, because I was told to say, don't run your lips too long, Harry. There are things to do. But I feel that this is a chance to say to each and every one of you that I never believed that at 81 years old I could be sensing anything that was truly different. I've done it all. I've been on top of the mountain. I've been on top of the game. I've been hustled, and I have hustled. I have been conned, and I have conned. But in this journey, how fortunate for me, how blessed I am, that Paul Robeson should have paused a moment to look in my young face and say, young man, you are worthy. I will invest in you. I'll invest in you the truth and all that I can bring you to help you understand and face this world. He was my mentor. And when he died, for a long moment, the space could not be filled. And then one day I ran into a man who has more than filled the place. He's in many ways validated my life. And with his inspiration and his own remarkable courage, I've been able to smile when I go around the world and know that everything's going to be all right. Danny Glover, I thank you for what you've given me. Stand up, man. Stand up. The former mayor of Berkeley, how long we have known each other. We are truly the elders. And when I flew in yesterday, I had to go see him because I heard he had an operation. And I walked in and I saw him looking like a black astronaut. Boy, his neck was up to here and braces and things were buzzing all over his body. I said, Gus Newport. I said, Gus, you know, if we're the elders, we can't be walking up there looking like, you know, the wreckage dump. Young people will think that we are over the hill. No, we're not. We're at the bottom of it. And I think it's going to be a steep climb, you know. But I got it. He got it. Thank you, Danny. I am validated by Walter Mosley, a great black writer. The only mistake he ever made was giving Denzel Washington the lead in A Devil in a Blue Dress when it should have been mine. But that's all right. And every day I wake up to validations that make me feel whole. Artists and young men who are silent in the courageous work that they do and much that they touch in profound ways. And they come and you see them, and they say, I am with you. We are of each other. And such a young man is Sean Penn. Sean, where are you? And for those who know about this cruel justice system and how ruthless and cruel it can be, none have stayed longer in the fight against legalized death and the cruelty of that kind of human punishment and the whole prison system than has Mike Farrell. Here from California. Come on, Mike. And to the Vanguard Foundation, which ensured our capacity to slowly build and grow until we could come to this moment, all of us are eternally grateful to Harry Dillon. I'm through now. There's a lot of great promise in this room. If you walk out of here this weekend feeling anything less than empowered and courageous, it's because you have not clearly understood what you're doing. When I first called for this gathering, and all those wonderful people showed up in Epps, Alabama, the first words out of some young Turks, I call them young thugs, kind of had attitude. And said, well, hey, look here, Mr. V, tell me, man, what's the agenda? And I looked at them and I said, the agenda is to find the agenda. It's a new day, filled with a history that gives you so much to choose from, so much to talk about, so much to reach clarity with. It's all yours. Don't let them kid you. The civil rights movement has never been over. It cannot be over. As long as there's the democratic society striving to exist somewhere in the world, there will be a civil rights and a human rights movement. Democracy requires it. Democracy is a fragile thing. It doesn't endure without nurturing. And those who are the beneficiaries of democracy must be the protectors of it. It will get away from you. Don't blink. It'll be over. And I absolutely agree fully. Barbara Lee, when she says, you have to fight for this nation. The experiment going on here is truly great. It has made most remarkable mistakes you could ever think of. The dichotomy, the differences, the conflicts, incredible collisions. How could this place that talks about the Bill of Rights and freedom and democracy be the same place that practiced such cruel slavery, that could destroy so many lives, that could be guilty of genocide even up until this moment? It is worth fighting for. And if we lose, it is because we have chosen to lose it. So I say to you, thank you for coming. Use this time. Stop the machine. If it does not yield to the greater truth, then it should yield to nothing except the stillness that we would insist on. They're afraid of nonviolence. Look what Dr. King did with it. Think about it. I've heard some young people say, hey, man, you know, that nonviolent thing, you know, I'm willing to try it because I just respect, you know, a couple of things that happened, but that ain't it, is it? I said, yes, it is. It is the only thing. Nonviolence is the tool. And if you want to know its real power, take a look at Nelson Mandela and South Africa and what he did with nonviolence. I just left him a few days ago. Spent a day with him discussing the future of our children, our youth, talking with him about where do we go from here. And he said we must stay the course with nonviolence and stand honorably against the enemy who would crush us. 27 and a half years in prison, and he ran a revolution that changed the landscape of the universe. look what we can do. And he did it nonviolently. Young men, young ladies, you make me whole. I don't know where I will go at the age of 81 or almost 81. I kind of look at the obituary columns, mostly to find out if I'm in it. But I realize that I have been blessed to have been able to come this far and still have peace of mind and opportunity to embrace and to love. And last but not least, just to let you know that I'm not without a moment of selfishness. For me to be able to say this yet again in another moment in my own journey, but to be able to say it with my 11-year-old granddaughter listening to this, because it is her world that I am fighting for. That she should be here to hear her grandfather once again speak truth to power is for me all the reward I need. Let's get on with it. Let's kick ass.